Hey, that Miles, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Miles.
And a drug addict and all the other fun things. So it is with my great pleasure to introduce the most amazing woman I've ever met in my entire life. She's someone that has taught me so much about myself and so much about how to treat another person. I met this woman about 7 months ago or 8 months ago, and just continually grown closer to her. And you know, through that relationship, like, she's helped me like understand like God more, and seeing how like two people can be compatible and really just love each other unconditionally without any other motive or any other thing besides just appreciating the other person. And you know, I watch her, you know, struggle and come out on the other side a better person. I'll get to see her and her relationship with her higher power continue to grow, and have gotten to form a relationship with her parents, which has been one of the coolest experiences I've ever had with a girlfriend. Just blows my mind. Just the relationship and understanding of what I was put here to do. So with that, I'll give you Hallie.
Yeah.
I'm Hallie. I'm an addict.
Hey, Hallie.
This is actually my first time telling my story. I did it once at a treatment center where I was at, but this audience is something I'm not used to, especially going after professional speakers. That's not what I'm going to do. you kind of been set up. When I told my mom I was speaking, she was like, "Oof, I'm nervous for you." So you're not only feeling my nervous energy, you're feeling my mom in the front. So there's a lot of weird nervous energy going on right now. I'm very nervous. Initially, like, I've never really felt qualified to tell my story, I guess because I just always considered it to be really boring. I don't have a lot of war stories. I don't have a lot of really, like, gritty and dark shit. To me, like, my internal condition has always been my own personal hell. There's nothing else outside that could really be as bad as the spiritual malady that I've had. I never thought I was entertaining enough to tell my story, but I do have like a quote-unquote mental illness, so I can tell you what it's like to be psychotic without drugs. So that's like what I can do. That's my little superpower. I can do that without anything, just me. But just a disclaimer on that, I do have a history of mental health, but we're not here to talk about mental illness. We're here to talk about the program and the spiritual malady. That's the greatest thing I'll ever face. So with that, you know, I don't want to spend too much time discussing my mental illness or diagnosis or anything like that. It is a part of my story, but it is not really the whole of my story. It's just something else that drives me further into sobriety, and it's something that reminds me that I have to be sober and I have to do maintenance spiritually as well as bodily, mentally, all of that. So with that, I'm pretty nervous. Okay. I had a pretty good childhood. I don't remember anything from childhood. I don't remember what I was good at. I don't remember having a hobby. All I knew growing up is that I wanted people to like me. I didn't have things I was interested in. I don't remember like getting interested in anything except for, did people like me? That's all I wanted. That has been my biggest obsession since I was a kid. I wanted to study people, and I wanted to study their reaction to me. I don't remember playing. Well, I did get put on the basketball team. That was a disaster. But I don't remember really having any interest. Like, building my identity was not something that I did. I wanted to sort of attach myself to another person. I would sit around and look at the kids in my class. I would observe who had the most likable personality, and I would try to sort of assimilate myself to that. I would watch people, I would study people, and I would see how they reacted to me. Did they like me? Did they smile at me? Do they approve of me? That's always been the biggest obsession of my life. That's what I remember as a kid. A typical day for me in like fourth or fifth grade is psychoanalyzing the shit out of everybody in class and then like going home and watching Lord of the Rings. Like that's what I did. That was a busy day for me. Like that was my life growing up. I don't remember really having other things that I thought about. I just wanted to be liked so bad. There was nothing else that existed for me except for getting approval from the people around me. And the craziest thing is that I spent so much time wondering if I was liked, but I would never, ever believe that anybody liked me. Like, that's the thing. It was never ending, and it was just a ridiculous mission that I put myself on. So building this kind of framework or building this identity for myself didn't really happen because I didn't care. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be liked. Like, me developing my own interests was just not something, it wasn't a priority. I wanted to be invited to the little, like, fifth grade parties. That was my shit. Like, I needed to be invited, you know? And I sort of developed this system of core beliefs about people and about myself. To me, one of my first core beliefs was that I had to be liked to be happy. If somebody did not like me, damn it, they were going to like me by the end of that class, okay? And it didn't care if I liked them or not. Honestly, if I dislike you and I'm trying to figure out how to make you like me, that's just a challenge. Like, I enjoy it. So when I was little, that's sort of what I believed. I had to be approved. I had to be liked. I had to be included. That was a very early on belief that I had for myself. And through that, I kind of developed this system of feeling like I had to perform to be liked. Growing up, I think around maybe second, third grade, I got glasses and headgear and a bowl cut. So I wasn't really like the hottest girl in the class. So I knew like the looks department was not going to be where I was going to excel, okay? That was not something I was going to be known for, was not happening. My mom will argue that I was cute. She's wrong, okay? Straight up, run-of-the-mill, ugly little kid, okay? That's what it was. So the headgear did not help. So I knew kind of early on, like, I wasn't going to be liked for my looks, and I knew that. So I had to really, like, quickly, on the spot, figure out how else. I was like, damn, how else are they going to like me? So I figured out, well, I can make people laugh. I can kind of use self-deprecation to make people laugh at me. And I was like, great, let's take it and run. So that's what I did. I made people laugh. I tried to kind of put myself down so that other people would think I was funny. That's how I coasted for a little while. I managed to sort of sneak into these little friend groups, and I would be like the one that would be kind of making jokes and being sarcastic. That was my thing. That's what I thought. Like, that was performance. I was a constant performer for other people. That's what I wanted to do. I had to be liked. And that was sort of where that belief system came from, that people did not like me for me. I had to be able to give them something. If I couldn't be good looking and I couldn't be as academically inclined as I thought I should be, I was going to make them laugh. And if I couldn't do that, well, I was going to stay home. And I think I did fairly well in school. But again, like, there's always this inherent belief that I wasn't good at anything. So it didn't matter how many straight A's I got. I didn't care. If I wasn't invited to so-and-so's little bullshit sleepover, then my life was over for me. And that's sort of the way that I grew up. I was happy, you know, nothing traumatic happened in my childhood. I just was obsessed with people. And to be honest, I always have been. Like, I can tell you right now, I will leave this room evaluating your facial expressions. I'm doing it now. I'm doing it right now. That's what I'm doing. That's my thing. It takes a lot of energy. I'm very tired most of the time from doing it. I have to take a lot of naps. But that's sort of the start of my internal condition. So I grew up doing that. I don't remember, like I said, anything terrible happening to me. I had a good childhood. I had a mom that was constantly driving me and was always there for me emotionally in every way. Also, to put it out there, because I like to say this, my mom was a firefighter growing up, so she was like a baller growing up. Like, that was a fact, okay? So she was one of the first women to be driving the fire truck in Gwinnett County. She was one of the first female firefighters at all. So That's a lot to live up to. Like, that's a little intense when you're like a weird kid that doesn't really know what they're good at. You know, you want to live up to that image, you know, of this woman who's like strong and like badass and like fighting fires and stuff. But for me, like, I kind of wondered. I was like, damn, I don't feel like her. Like, something's not right. I'm not like her. Like, I don't feel as good as she. Like, she seems to have this shit figured out. I don't know what's wrong with me. I seem to be a lot more emotional than her. Like, something ain't right. And that's who I looked up to, though. And I'm very grateful. My parents were divorced. So they were divorced when I was a baby. I had an okay relationship with my father. He wasn't really emotionally there for me most of the time. Like, daddy issues, like, big surprise, you know, like, that's, I'm sure you guys were wondering. here's the result of dad issues. But, so anyway, he was present, but not really emotionally so, and that's okay. But, and, you know, people talk about telling their stories. It's really not so much as a story for me as it is just a bunch of weird, shitty beliefs that I had about myself. That's what I'm telling you. So, sorry if it's kind of boring. So I get into high school, and this was my thing, too. I didn't drink or use very much in high school. I just didn't. And it wasn't because it wasn't because of morals. It wasn't because I wanted to do the right thing. I just wasn't invited. That was the thing that pissed me off, was that I wanted to do bad stuff. It just, people weren't inviting me. That was the worst, to be honest. I remember I kept thinking, like, how do I let them know that I want to do bad shit with them? I just wasn't invited. Like, I just wasn't known, you know? I wanted to drink and do bad stuff. I just did not, I was not invited, you know? Like, that was, it was not something that I was a part of, and that really drove me crazy. I know a lot of you guys know that with social media, now you also get to see the physical evidence of when you were left out. So that's been great for me. You know, you get to see not only when you were left out, but how it happened. And you can see pictures of what you were not a part of. So that's great. Thank you, Facebook, for that. So I didn't get in with the drinking crowd or the using crowd. I just didn't. I sort of coasted again, tried to develop these friendships with women, which were kind of shallow because I would never ever let them see what I was really feeling. I just was going to try to, again, make them laugh. And so eventually, though, there became this sort of shift. In my junior year, there was a big thing that happened to me, and that's boys. So I will tell you, I don't know if you guys knew this, but in around 2012, I don't know if I'm right on the years or not, so if anybody knows, you can tell me, yoga pants came in, okay? They were a big thing. They came in. They got in style. And for me, like, as I told you, I had never really been looked at, desired, none of that. I had a history of being made fun of for my looks, you know, which is okay. Like, it's not a poor me thing. It was just, I wasn't wanted. And I figured out that, hey, I think men like when we wear tight clothes. So I sort of had that hypothesis, and it worked. So all of a sudden, now I was being faced with all of this. Well, not a lot, you know. But, like, for the first time in my life, I had gotten attention. I got attention from men. I don't know about the ladies in this room, but that's my first drug of choice. So it doesn't even have to be for men. It's attention. I want validation. I want to be seen. I want people to tell me that they like me. And if you're a member of the opposite sex, thank you so much. You've made my day. Like, my purpose in life is now fulfilled. You have complimented my yoga pants. Thank you very much. So that was how I kicked it in junior year. All of a sudden, I was getting attention, and I had never had it before from anybody. So I loved it. Like, you know, I had a therapist tell me that relationships were my primary addiction. And it's not relationships, it's validation. That's the first thing that made me feel excited about life. That's sad, isn't it? But that was the first thing that made me feel excited. Getting people to notice me, people to want me. First person that it's meant their whole life not really being seen or feeling like they weren't. So that became my biggest obsession. And again, that lack of identity is still there. It's still following me because all the while, I'm not really developing anything. I'm not doing well in school. I'm not doing anything extracurricular. I'm not figuring out what I like. I'm figuring out how to get the next asshole to text me back. That's my thing, you know? So that lack of identity continues to follow me. I start getting attention from boys. I'm like, man, this is great. Like, I didn't go to class today, but, like, listen to what happened. You know what I mean? Like, that was what was, that's what got me off. And it was became this huge obsession to me. Like, and I'm sure we can all relate to that. You know, when you meet somebody and you like them, that hormone goes off. That was what it was like for me. And very quickly it became like if I did not have a guy that was around kind of feeding me attention, I would feel low and empty, almost like the way you feel when you don't drink or use. So that was my first big thrill in life, was getting attention. And, you know, I met the first guy in my life that I really, really got into. Like, I was real, really hooked on this guy. And he wasn't a great guy, but I was addicted to the attention from him. And this was something else I did. I like to morph into whatever person liked me. So this is an example of how I acted with men. So I would go on their Facebook. I would look and see, like, their interests. Like, he would say, Ben likes Scarface and Pink Floyd. So later on, when Ben would text me, he'd be like, hey, what are you doing? I'd be like, just watching Scarface. Like, that's what I did. That's real. That's what I did, okay? That's the truth. That's exactly how I played it out, because I didn't have any of my own interests. Like, I had to be whatever he wanted me to be. If he liked freaking, you know, Pink Floyd and all these movies, I would research it, I would study it, and then I would, like, throw out little quotes, see if he, like, understood what I was like, see, we like the same things, you know, like, that's what I did. So, and, you know, this guy entertained me for a little while, the first guy I really, really loved, and he was a year older than me. He graduated, so I quickly realized that when this guy was gone, I didn't have anything. I was kind of empty inside. I didn't know what I was good at. And we were approaching, like, we were getting towards graduation. And I was like, oh, shit, I've got to graduate. So I took my SATs once. I did not bring a calculator. It did not go well. That was the only time I took them. So I'm glad that I was able to graduate. I remember telling my family, like, don't buy a plane ticket just yet. We don't know if it's going to happen. But I did graduate, and when I did, I just was empty. I didn't have anything. And this guy that I had put all of my worth into was gone. And so I graduated high school and felt extremely aimless. And I didn't really have much of an identity. And I didn't have any interests. I just didn't know, and I didn't care. And a little bit then is when drugs started to enter the picture for me. I started smoking weed all the time, drinking all the time. I would take pills with my stepsister. We were like partners in crime. And that's what I did. And I realized when I got high, like, that gave me an identity. Now I belonged. I could get high and I could feel I didn't care as much, and I could feel like I belonged to something. I had a relationship with something, and it was my best friend. So that's sort of when my love affair with drugs began. It was after high school. I was in community college, not doing shit. I was working at some restaurants, you know, you guys know the deal. And there was one night when this guy, the guy I was really into, he had graduated. We had been messing around, and he invited me to his cabin in Alabama. Don't go to cabins that people invite you to. That's weird, okay? Like, if some random dude asks you to go to a cabin by yourself, you shouldn't go. That's a weird thing. I don't know why I thought. Anyway, so I drove to Alabama to this cabin, because that's, I would drive to another state for attention. That's me. But I drove to this cabin to see this guy. And I remember getting really wasted, drinking, anything that was there I would do. I had no discretion when it came to drugs. I don't have a drug of choice. It's whatever is there. So I got really I got messed up. I got really wasted. We were in his cabin. It was just me and him. I remember walking down the stairs to his room, and that's really all I remember from there. I woke up, as I just said, and I was really sore in weird places. I felt soreness not only in one area but in another. I didn't understand it. I was like 18 at the time. I didn't equate that to rape. I didn't know. You know, I just knew that I had gone to see this guy, and when I felt sore the next day in different places, like, I just didn't care. You know, I didn't think about it. I never never said to myself, oh, hey, that was rape. You know, like somebody did that to you when you were asleep. I didn't think about that. Later on, I realized it, you know, because it's something you don't forget. But for me, I sort of pushed it to the corner of my mind. And I never thought about it again, not until years later. And I never thought about it. Like I said, I didn't cry about it. I didn't say, oh, my God, somebody did this to me when I was asleep. None of that. I never thought about it again. I went home and I got high. That's what I did. And I didn't feel bad. I didn't feel pity for myself, anything like that. I just kept on getting high. And I realized that I could keep getting high, and that felt really good. And I would get high and I would go for runs around the neighborhood, and I would go for runs around areas where he lived. And I quickly realized that I couldn't, for some reason, couldn't stand to be in the same area as him. We live very close to each other, so I would run in places where he lived, and I would feel this feeling of like, oh shit, I can't be in this city anymore. And for some reason, I sort of felt like I had to get out. I had to get out. Like, the whole issue of geographical salvation was like, that is the best to me. I still kind of get into that. But so I decided that it would be really cool if I moved to Colorado, which it is cool. And I got a job at a goat farm where I milked goats for about 3 or 4 months. That was cool. I enjoy that. I milk the goats. I could tell you a lot of goat trivia, but that's later. But we're not going to talk about that. But I can if you. Anyway, so I moved to Colorado, and I truly believed that this was going to be the thing that was going to cure me. Like, I was like, I'm going to feel so much better. I'm doing this kick-ass thing by myself. And, like, big surprise, it didn't work. I was just as miserable in Colorado as I ever was anywhere else. You can be in one of the most beautiful places in the world, but when you take yourself and your spiritual malady with you, I guarantee you, it doesn't matter. That's how it was for me. I could be sitting and looking at the most beautiful sunset across a mountain, fucking birds flying, little goats walking around. I didn't care. I was miserable. I was depressed. I hated myself. I did not want to be there anymore. So I came back. I came back home. And this is sort of where the tail end of things happen, is that I came back home, and all the while could not stop using. And this time it was getting worse. I was not only engaging in weed, drinking, but any pills, any drug I could get, I was going to get it. And I didn't have a second thought about it. My mother pleaded with me to stop getting high. It broke her heart, but I didn't care. I wasn't going to stop. And when she kicked me out of the house, I was like, cool, now I can use and be free and not have to worry about the awkwardness of coming home. So, great. So this second time around, I do another example of the geographical salvation. I moved to Athens. That's a great place for any addict, so that's great. I really thought that was going to work out. I felt really good about that move to Athens. And so I'm using constantly. Now, here is where I get into the mental health subject, okay? This is how I tell you how to get crazy without drugs. So I moved to Athens. I'm seeing a guy there. I'm liking him. And I start feeling really, really happy for some reason out of nowhere. And I'm not really engaging in drugs because I'm so damn happy just naturally that I'm like, maybe I don't really need to use drugs anymore, which you would think would be great. But I get really, really excited. I'm starting to wake up in the morning and feel amazing about where I'm at. I'm thinking, damn, I've really got all the answers. Like, this is great. I'm waking up. I'm going to this restaurant job. And I'm like, this is the happiest damn time of my life. I'm like, this is living right here. So I'm super, super happy. Now, that's a little bit of a warning sign, you guys. That's not really proportional. But anyway, to me, I was excited. I loved life. And I didn't question it. That's the scary thing about mania, is that you're not going to question it until it's too late. Because why would you? So I was feeling extremely happy. And that was great. I loved it. But what happened was that I started to stay up all night. I was not sleeping. I think we're all familiar with that. I don't need to talk about not sleeping to a room full of addicts. But so I wasn't sleeping. And give it, you know, mind you, I was not using or drinking at this time. This was purely me. Not sleeping, staying up for nights, feeling amazing. I babysat for a musician, His name's Kishibashi. He, like, lives in Athens. I was babysitting for him, and after a couple days of not sleeping, I thought it would be a really good idea to kind of borrow his ukulele to show the world what an amazing musician I was. I can't play any instruments, by the way. Anyway, so I could go on and on about that. But anyway, so the thing is that I'm not sleeping. I'm feeling great. I'm feeling full of energy every single day. And it got to the point where it was almost euphoric. I felt like I understood the entire world. I felt like God was speaking directly to me, like I had no fear of death. I felt like I was already sort of one foot in heaven. And now that sounds beautiful, and it was, but again, that's not proportional to life. There was no sanity in that. That was me in another universe, day in and day out, purely sober. And I was alone in Athens. I wasn't around my family, so I was sort of just kind of getting to this mania by myself. And I took that ukulele and started deciding, and that's another thing, is that I had extreme confidence, right? Which to a person like me is a huge blessing. You know, you want to be confident. That's, to me, the thing I've always been able to get, or never, you know, I've never had it. So I take the ukulele, I start driving to different places to play it or not play it, because I can't play an instrument. And anyway, I just go crazy. I can spend a lot more time describing to you what a manic episode is, but we're not here for that. I think you guys get the gist of it. And unfortunately, the thing about mania is that it's great until it's not. It's a wave. It's got to crash. And when it does, it sucks. It got to the point where I didn't understand how I had gotten to places. I would drive to different places. I would end up in different areas, and I did not understand how I had gotten there. I couldn't keep track of time. I thought people were out to get me, all that shit. So eventually, my mother came down to Athens and got a little intervention going with my roommates, where they said, hey, we think something's wrong with you and you might need to be evaluated. And I thought they were throwing me like a surprise party. Like, I didn't know that it was an intervention. That's kind of where I was at that point. So I went to the psych ward for the first time. It was probably one of the most terrifying things that's ever happened, is just not being able to get a grasp of your own mind, feeling like you don't have control over your own head, which I'm sure you guys all can relate to. For me, I just was scared, because I was like, I haven't been using drugs, so I don't really understand why this is happening to me. But I was diagnosed as bipolar. And, you know, I'm aware that I know a lot of people that are misdiagnosed. I know a lot of drug addicts that are misdiagnosed. That's a very common thing, and unfortunately, I'm not one of them. I could give you a good way of finding out whether or not it's a real diagnosis, but you wouldn't want to go through that. Anyway, I was diagnosed, and the thing to me is that now I had all these symptoms of my so-called illness, and I had no idea of how to get rid of the symptoms. Just as any addict, we have these symptoms of our malady. Whatever you want to call it, an illness, anything, it doesn't matter. There are these symptoms. And how to treat them and manage them was something that I did not understand how to do. And that is when I dove even more heavily into drugs and alcohol. And that is when I felt the need for drugs and alcohol more than I ever did before. Because now I had an identifiable problem and I needed a cure. And that was getting wasted. So I dove deeper into drugs and alcohol than I ever did before. My therapist thought it might be a good idea to maybe get some friends and get out of the house. So she suggested sober living. So I went to sober living. I did not think I was an addict. I thought I was a person that had brain problems, so I did not associate that with being an addict. So I was in sober living. I left. I wanted to get high again. For me, the depression that comes after a manic episode is the scariest thing to me. That's where I really wanted drugs and did not have a will to live anymore. So I left the sober living. I continued getting high. And one of the things that keeps me sober is that what I've learned is that when I drink or when I use, that almost launches my mania. When I drink or when I get high, I feel the effects of my mental illness at a greater severity than I ever would. That's one of the things that keeps me sober. And that's one of the things that I have to tell myself. I was using for a little while and living on my own, and I couldn't keep a job anymore. Things were very unmanageable. And I felt my sanity kind of slipping away. I saw it in my mom's eyes when she looked at me. I knew she knew something wasn't right. So she said, you know, I got arrested. I got a DUI. I kind of was just fucking up left and right. And I couldn't manage anything, and I was angry, too. And I felt myself slipping. I could feel the screws of my brain kind of becoming unhinged again. And that terrified me. And I think I gave in. I don't know what it was, but I gave in. I just knew that I couldn't manage anything anymore. I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't do anything. And, God, I couldn't even pay for my Spotify. Like, I just could not do anything when I was using. So I gave in. I went to Ridgeview. And for a person that has never felt like they had an identity or ever felt like they belonged, being able to sit in a room and say, I am an addict, that was the biggest relief I've ever had, because I finally feel like, okay, here is where I belong. This is what I am. I've never had an identity or anything to call myself, so the ability to say I am an addict has been, it's a huge relief. It feels good to me. Not always, but it felt good at the time. But the thing about me in early treatment was I wanted to be sober. I had a desire to be sober, but I had no desire to give up any element of self. I was extremely egotistical. I took myself very seriously. I thought the world was out to get me. I wanted to be sober, but I did not want to have any rules or any directions, okay? That was not what I was going to do. I was going to sponsor myself. I was going to manage myself. And so I'm at Ridgeview, and really enjoying treatment. That's a weird thing. If you're, like, having a good time, yeah, if you're, like, enjoying rehab, you're probably not doing it right. It's not really, like, a vacation, but for me it was. While I was there, I sort of engaged in this relationship with a woman there. That's another thing. You probably shouldn't get a rehab girlfriend. I know that we all do that, but it's a great thing. I mean, they tell you don't form relationships in rehab, but it's the quickest way to see what your defects are. So that's what I did. And I formed this relationship with this woman. I'm in treatment. I'm like, I'm fucking killing it. Like, I'm like, I'm doing great. I'm going to live here forever. Like, I will stay in this sober living house for as long as I can, me and my beautiful girlfriend. Like, living happily ever after. The world can burn down. You know, like, we're good. And of course, you know, the treatment Ridgeview told me, they were like, you might need to go to somewhere else. And I was really shocked. I was like, I'm doing really good here. Like, I don't know why I'm being sent somewhere else. I was like, I'm a really good model of sobriety. Like, I share, you know, like I led a damn meeting the other night, you know, like my girlfriend was next to me. Like, we're doing fine. And I did not understand. I was like, I want to stay. And for some reason, though, I was really willing. I got sent to a place that actually did for me what I could not do for myself. I got sent to a place called Graceway in Albany. It was in deep South Georgia, very isolated, not a lot of stuff going on. And that was the place that really humbled me, because for me, I could not just go to sober living or do it on my own. I had to be stripped down. My ego had to be smashed. I could not just do a run-of-the-mill or watered-down thing for me. Like, and thank God, because I had to be stripped down completely. All of my little identity problems and all the little bullshit that I was living with my whole life needed to be erased. I needed to be humbled, and I needed to be sat down and told what to do. And that's what happened, and it was horrible. But, so it was like boot camp with Tampax. So it was bad. It was horrible, you guys. It was terrible. No 20-year-old or 21-year-old is going to want to go to like a little farm and be told to do yard work and pray and meditate at 6 a.m., okay? It's terrible. It's not supposed to be fun, and it wasn't. But it was the thing that truly got me to that point with God where I had to sit with God and be like, I surrender. Please help me get through this next day here. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't try to leave, because I did. I tried to leave about 3 times. It got more embarrassing each time, but I stayed. I don't know how I made it through. I really don't. I saw a lot of girls leave. I don't know why I made it. I just know that I got to this point where I had to look God in the face and say, please show me what to do and please help me get through this day. And I'm a firm believer in, if you really want to stay sober, you've got to come to that point with your Creator. You've got to be able to do that and surrender and completely get rid of all self-reliance and tell your higher power, please help me take each step of this day. That's what helped me. So I stayed there for about a year. And how much time do I got? Shortly after that, I started working there. About 6 months in, I was living in the apartments, transitional apartments next door, and they gave me a job. Like, they gave me a job. I had tried to leave there 3 times, and they asked me to work there. That was a little weird to me. But so I got the opportunity to work at this treatment center, and I got the opportunity to work with these women. And truly, being able to sit across from another person, like, no. Okay, these women, like working with these women, working with women and being able to work in that treatment center was the first love of my life. It was the purest, purest love I had ever felt. And that was huge to me. I never knew what I wanted to do. I never had any ambition. I never had any plans for my life. But when I got to work at that treatment center, I felt at home. Like, I knew what I was going to do. I knew what my purpose was in my life. That was a big thing for me. And it's been one of the best parts of my life. One of the greatest things that anybody could ever do would be to give me the chance to work with another addict. I don't know why they did that. I'm so glad they did. And I got the chance to do that. And that's really what I fell in love with. That's where I fell in love with sort of the pure self that I knew I could be. We had a man last night tell us, be in love with your future self. It gave me the hope that maybe one day I could do for them what had been done for me. So that was beautiful to me. And I didn't stay there. I worked there for about 6 months, and I came back home, and I still don't know the specifics of what I'm going to do with my life. I just know the general purpose, which is good for now. I know that I need to help people. I know that I need to be able to sit across from another person and work directly with them. That's really all I know. And but it's amazing knowing that. Just having that direction for me has been the best thing that's ever happened to me. Just having that dream. And I don't know a lot of specifics as to what degree I'm going to get or what I'm going to do later on down the road, but I know that I will do whatever I can to be able to work with people and to be able to make some difference or just be able to listen to them as people have listened to me. That's very special to me. So I came back home, and I felt very lost, but I knew I wanted to stay sober, and I knew what my purpose was. I knew what God's will was for me at that time. And I guess I had this foundation of tools. Because I had been crushed and my ego had been completely deflated for a certain amount of time, I kind of carried that with me, and I sort of knew what to do. Intuitively, I understood how I was going to handle things. Not very well, but that's what I did. And I moved back home. I worked at a restaurant for a little while, and I got a job at a mental health center, which is a little different than a treatment center for addicts, but again, it's sort of that same path as I don't care what it is. If I can help somebody and hear them out, that's what I'll do. I'll go wherever I can do that. And so now I work there. I work there, and that's been amazing, just to be able to see people. And just be able to, God, if I only get a little bit of interaction with a client where I ask them how they're doing and they can tell me and I can sit there and look them in the eye and hear them out, like, that's it. That's all I really need to do for the day, you know? And so I work there now. And I definitely, it hasn't been easy. I say the second year of my sobriety has probably been the harder one because I now have the freedom to fuck up, and I have used that freedom. I've made bad choices in sobriety, yes. I left that treatment center, and I was like, let's get it. Like, my ego came back full force. I was like, now we're going to do what we want. But, you know, luckily for me, that spiritual tools that I learned and was given, I've been able to carry them. Thank God. I do have to take some type of maintenance for my mental health, which I fall short of. But I've been avoiding my therapist. But I have to take medication and all that shit. I got to make sure that's on cue. I have to do that. I have to maintain my mental state of being. That's important to me. I have to make sure somebody knows what's going on with my mental health. But more so than that, I have to maintain a spiritual program. Because I know there's going to be a lot of stupid shit that I'm going to do. And I need to know that God is still going to be with me when I'm doing that. I need to know that we're on good terms before I do something stupid. So that's been very helpful to me. I've also, you know, I've had the privilege to be in a relationship with somebody, which I've never had before. I mean, I've truly, with my core beliefs when it comes to men, I've never ever wanted a relationship with somebody and never believed that anybody would want a relationship with me. So that's been amazing. And I've been able to grow with somebody, and I've also been able to understand what it's like to have a person love you unconditionally. And to know that even if I'm not performing properly, this person is still going to love me. So that's been huge. And, that's really all I have to say about that. So, thank you. Yeah.
Break and come back and wrap it up with 12 steps.